This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5. I want to remind you that if you want to listen to the Taylor Report interview on your computer or mobile device, well, you can. The Taylor Report is on Facebook at facebook.com/The Taylor Report. Facebook.com, The Taylor Report. You can click on all the interviews as they're uploaded, and they're also on SoundCloud, soundcloud.com/Taylor-Report. And we're back, of course, with everyone here. We now have Phil Condon, who's regular with Taylor Report. How are you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil.
You've had the pleasure of 20 minutes at least speaking to our guest.
It has been a pleasure.
Harry Glaspick. And thanks, Harry, for being here. This is Harry Glaspick in the studio with us. We almost caught up with you last week.
It was very close.
A very evasive man. We're going to get into evasion here. The book is Class Privilege, How Law Shelters Shareholders and Coddles Capitalism. And it's Labor Day, and if anybody knows about how this, you know, goes on, it's the labor movement. I just spoke to a young man, actually, from Unifor, and I think he needs your book. And Harry, but you say you really want to put this book to some use. You're trying to be of help, not just an academic study.
No, that's the purpose.
And I remember your motivation. We've spoken to you in the past. You have had a view that too many people are injured on jobs, too many people die at work, and with no consequences. And people always expect, particularly if they see a headline, that something is going to come of this, and it will have a little reform, and we will move on. As I read your book, I don't get the impression that a lot of reform has happened. Why is that? Well, you can talk from there.
Well, you're absolutely right. We get very little by way of redress and reform for all the many ugly things that happen all around us. Health and safety in the workplace is one of them. We've had the same kind of legislation now for well over 40 years now. Even this morning's newspaper announced that there were the same number of people dying on the job as have always died on the job, the same number of people being injured on the job as always injured on the job. So you wonder what all that expensive legislation is really doing for workers. And it does require a lot of administering, and a lot of people are seriously trying to make it work, but it doesn't work because it basically does not address the fundamental problem. And the fundamental problem is always the same. Capitalism works as a coercive system. And so workers.
Coercive.
Coercive, yes. Yeah. And the workers who come to work do not do so voluntarily. They do so because they need a job. They can't get shelter. They can't get necessities of life. They can't have any of the things they need unless they work for someone. That someone is an employer, somebody who owns wealth. And by pretending it's a voluntary arrangement, we can start pretending that a certain number of risks are willing to be borne by the workers, or for that matter, a consumer, or a community in general. Once you make that assumption, of course, then any number of risks that materialize will be seen lightly. They will say, oh, that's the natural way of things. Well, there's nothing natural about it. And that is the real problem. And that's what the book is about in its way. I try to identify one way that this kind of injustice is perpetrated and maintained. And that's what I try to do in the book.
Yeah. Well, you certainly start. There's a very important theme that you develop, which is that our apprehension of the system we're talking about is it gets kind of lost in some of the language. And there is a phenomenon called the corporation.
Yes.
And as I read your account, you use better words for this than corporation. You say a veil. You say it's a mask. You'll call it a blob. Is there another word? Ectoplasm? Did I get that one?
Yes.
Not human, because when anybody has a problem, say the Westray mine or the Lac-Mégantic, et cetera, and they say, well, let's get busy and get to the bottom of who's responsible, et cetera, they enter this thing called the corporation, or it enters. And on top of everything else, we're told it's a person.
Yes.
Yeah. So,
tell me about it.
What is this mass bandit?
We always thought lawyers have no imagination, and it's really silly. I mean, the invention of the corporation is just an unbelievably clever thing. It interposes an entity, which we then call a person, and for reasons I'll give in a minute, but we then call it a person, which then becomes the responsible actor. And that makes it very difficult to assign responsibility to the human beings who benefit from this activity. And that's really what lies at the core of the problem. The corporation is an entity because what we do is we have this notion, and law promotes this notion, that if we put a lot of little capitals together, a lot of little pieces of property together, and form one big gob of property, the deployment of that big gob will be more efficient, more productive, more profitable than would all these little blobs by themselves in a discrete way. So having all that big gob of money, however, or property in one place, it requires somebody to be able to deploy it. Now, all these people have put little bobs in. Not one of them is the person to deploy it. So we invent the person. It's called the corporation. We have to make it a person. It's a legal entity. And then when we say a
I'm sorry.
So, no, go ahead.
And no, I was just going to say it doesn't vote or...
No, it doesn't think. It doesn't act. It's soulless. It is empty. It's any shape you like. That's why in my classes I used to call it the blob. I've got thousands of students out there in Bay Street who still call it the blob because you can make it any shape you like and any size you like. And it's an astonishing thing we do. It becomes instantly adult. There is no time for, you know, foreplay or sex or growing up. It's instantly an adult, and it's immortal. It only dies when somebody else kills it or eats it. Mm. And it notionally never dies. It can instantly reproduce and give rise to exactly the same kind of persons. And everybody knows it's not a person, of course. Everybody knows that. There's actually some quite funny things. A couple of them are in the book. There was a man called Feynman out in California who went out and wanted to prove that it wasn't a person. And so he drove in a carpool lane in Los Angeles or San Francisco, I'm not sure where. And and he was driving along, and of course he got pulled up as he wanted to be because he was a single man driving in a carpool lane. And he said, no, I'm with a passenger. Look, I've got the Articles of Association of my corporation sitting next to me in the passenger seat. And then they didn't accept that. They said, that's not a person. Or there was a woman who got a permit to get married. And she was going to marry somebody called a corporate person. She said she was a bit worried because although he was an adult, he'd only been alive for 1.5 months. And she went through a wedding ceremony. But the administrators revoked the permit and gave her back her $64. So everybody knows they're not persons. Mm. But for all legal purposes, for all functional purposes, for all assignment of responsibilities, we treat them as if they were persons. Now, that's an extraordinary thing. And by interposing that corporation, the people who think, because there have to be people who think, and they're the directors who make the policy for the corporation, and the people who make it work, the executives who direct the workers, who actually do the work to do that, the people who think and act are not immediately responsible. To make them responsible, we pass special statutes. But it's very difficult because what they do, they say, well, it wasn't me at that particular moment. Or alternatively, yes, it was me. But I tell you what, we'll make the corporation accept the responsibility if you let us off the hook. And that's what you get in all the bankster cases. You know, you had all these AIGs and Barclays and Royal Bank of Scotland and J.P. Morgan, and not one of them went to jail. Well, what's the reason? Well, we knew who the scallywags were, right? The people who stole people's houses and monies. We know all of that. We can point them out. We know who they walk around in the streets, and we can identify them in pictures. None of them were actually even prosecuted. What did they do? Well, they said to the federal authorities, well, I tell you what, find a corporation.
Yeah.
And the corporation was fine, with taxpayers' money, of course, because that's how they were paid for it. But the corporation was like, and these guys are still walking around and advising Trump and whoever they're advising. Nothing happens. So the interposition of the corporation is a remarkable legal hurdle to getting any kind of justice in our society.
Yeah. And by the way, this is Harry Glasspeak. The book is Class Privilege, How Law Shelters Shareholders and Coddles Capitalism. And it's Between the Lines Press, I believe.
It is, yes.
By the way, everybody in the labor movement ought to have the book. I was just speaking to the young man from uniform. If one of the things they should do is have this at their elbow. I put the thesis of your book into kind of a sentence. Corporations are a blob that do harm, but there isn't any alternative. There is no alternative.
That's what we're told continuously.
Isn't this roughly?
Yeah, no, that's it. And we are told this because if you go back to the original proposition, we've devised this entity where we accumulate capitals. So therefore, we think this generates a great deal more wealth than we otherwise would generate. And that's true, I imagine, because cooperation and aggregation should lead to better results. And that's what we do. So we say there is no other alternative because that's how we create wealth for our society. But, of course, that is not what most of the people need or want. For instance, that wealth, even if it's accumulated, let's say we accumulate £1 million more, $1 million more than we otherwise would, that would only be good if most of the people share in that. Mm-hmm. Other than that, it's of little use. And that's what really happens.
Yeah, you introduced me to a word that I have to confess I didn't recognize, ilth. There's wealth and ilth.
It comes from John Ruskin. John Ruskin was a 19th century mm-hmm. poet and critic.
Well, poets always cause problems.
Yes, they do. They're the most militant of all of us. And John Ruskin sort of collated the two words, wealth and ill. Right? Wealth was good and ill was bad. So he put them together. When you have bad things, it's ilth.
Yes.
Ill and the TH from the wealth.
Ilth being wasted wealth.
Wasted wealth and complete.
Extra yachts.
Extra yachts or, for that matter, extra damage.
Or building tanks.
Yes. To go back to the question of how you create efficiency, the corporate sector as a whole, let's assume that it creates this huge amount of wealth that we otherwise wouldn't have. But that's in money terms. Mm-hmm. It isn't necessarily in things we need. It just creates money, which, after all, is of no use whatsoever by itself. So what we don't subtract from all that money-making the harms that are being done. Now, if we did that for each corporation, we might come up with minuses rather than pluses. Say, for instance, if you take, I don't know, General Motors or Volkswagen recently, where they do some terrible, terrible polluting damage. Mm-hmm. As they make cars. That should be deducted from the wealth that's being generated. Volkswagen is still advertising, still very rich, still doing very well and still generating money, still employing workers. But it's caused pollution, causing bronchitis, deaths. It's caused damages on the road. We require oil. We require lawyers for the litigation. None of this is subtracted. In fact, all of it creates money. All of those things themselves are money-making ventures, even though there is money being spent to remedy things which are wrong with our society mm-hmm. because of the wealth creation in the first place. So what we have when we saw that there is no other way is just a statement by people who like money.
Yes. And by the way, that leads you also to treat skeptically reformers because there's always a group of what they call inclusive capitalists,
yes.
Of people who capitalism with a human face, perhaps.
Yeah. Yes,
but talk about some of the of that and why you are skeptical of that.
Well, because they don't change. They don't want to change anything really. What they really want to change what they really fear is the better way of putting it is that people will get angry. There is so much obvious injustice. Now, people have concentrated now on the wealth disparities and income disparities in our society. And in this part of the world, the Occupy Wall Street movement and then the famous book by Piketty and it's made it very clear that we have huge, huge gaps in wealth. People are angry because they don't have anything despite all this creation of wealth. And that's throughout the world. There are many, many worse situations than we're suffering over. over here. So people are angry, and they see people having yachts, as you put it, and way too much yachts. I mean, I don't know whether we have time to do this, but I one of the things I used to tell my students that perhaps useful is to think of how much money there is in money terms, not necessarily welfare terms, but money terms. We talk very easily about a billion these days with a B and yes. not with an M, as if yes. it's nothing. Well, I can't work that with my classes. If you want to count up to a billion, $1 at a time, it takes 20 years to count to a billion. So when you talk about a trillion, which is a billion.
Please don't
billion,
do that.
No.
Do not do that at all.
No. But so what you when these people have all that money, and so many people have little money and little ways of providing for themselves, and yet are taught to want things, because that's how capitalism works, they might get angry. And they might get angry, and that's what the reformers are about. It is one famous guy, Hanauer, who formed a famous company with Bezos, and they became immensely. He calls himself a zillionaire. He said, but he's worried lest the peasants come out with the pitchforks. He said, I'm making too much money, and I've got to worry. So he's an inclusive man. He said, let's make it nicer for them. Let them have a few trade unions. Let them have a bit more health and safety. Do not tax me a little more. I can afford this, right? And that will keep the peasants out of the street, right? But most capitalists do not think like that, of course.
We're speaking to Harry Glasspiegel, and the book is Class Privilege, How Law Shelters Shareholders and Coddles Capitalism. And by the way, close your book, you do point out, it is interesting, class consciousness is very developed in the upper levels of our society. The rest of us are told, you're all middle class. I went to grammar school, and I remember the teacher asked, what class do we belong to? And she allowed us to talk, and we all agreed we were in the middle class because there was no other class where we ought to be, because if you said anything else, it'd be trouble. You know, one understood, if you say I'm poor, it's going to be some trouble. And if you're rich, well, and not in our class. Mm-hmm. But these gentlemen that you're referring to, they have all these fantasies because they know
Yes, they
what they've done. In a sense, they've already committed the crime, so they're wondering, is anybody going to find out?
Yes, exactly that.
About this
well,
crime.
I think I have a quote in there from Warren Buffett, who actually says, we've been waging a class war and we've won.
Yes.
Right?
And that is a chilling. I wish we'd all remember that from him.
Especially when we honor him so much.
Yes. And you take on a villain that I was so glad to see his name again, because I recall this argument from school days, Mr. von Hayek, who warned us all that we must not be talking about workers organizing, about government control over companies that want to build pipelines through native reserves and whatnot, because we'd be killing, the old expression was the goose that laid the golden egg, and we were on the road to serfdom. By the way, I think the book is successful because of the title. That's a very nice title.
Yes.
But you say he might have it the road backwards.
Yes, well, his great intellectual achievement, and it was, because he was ignored most of his life, you know. It was only when Thatcher came along that he came to prominence again. His great intellectual achievement was to translate the market from merely being a mechanism of exchange and investment to an actual assessor of values, that it was the only arbiter of right and wrong, that if it was valuable in the market, it was a good thing. If it was not valuable in the market, it was not a good thing, and there are no other values. It is so anti-human, it's hard to expostulate about it, hard even to get angry about it. It shouldn't have got any merit whatsoever. But of course, it is the governing mantra of all those people who walk around saying, Tina, there is no alternative to having the market being the arbiter of everything.
Yeah, it is. We have these people. Of course, I guess Reagan was the first major one to just sort of make that the mantra of the country.
In the United States. It was Thatcher before that, I guess.
Yeah, and meeting with Ayn Rand in his office and these people who would say the road to serfdom. But your point is actually if you want to escape serfdom and you want equality and human life, you have to go the other direction. People actually have to take power to themselves. I was thinking today of the old expression, now out of no longer in use, industrial democracy, and developed by the there was a husband-wife team in London. The Fabians,
yes.
The Webs.
Yeah, I my memory is poor for names. Yes, the Webs.
Pardon me.
No, my memory is poor for names. It's the Webs. Yeah,
and that would be the road to freedom,
yes,
and away from serfdom. Otherwise, we're in the employ of the Buffetts and the Trumps and whomever's, right?
I think one of the difficulties, I think that is right for me, as you, seeing that you read the book, for me that is the right way to approach these big issues. I think the difficulty for all of us is that capitalism is a total system. So every aspect of our life is governed by it. So we find it hard to have capitalism as a target. We can't just walk around and say, let's end capitalism. And so that's why the reformers come in. They attack little bits of it without attacking mm-hmm. the basic structure of it. What I want to do going through the corporation is to be metaphysical, as a meta level attack, uh-huh. political attack. Attack the people who actually benefit from it now, identify them, and make them say in public, I'm entitled to get more than you are. I am better than you are. I deserve more political influence than you have just simply because I'm rich. If mm-hmm. we can identify people, and I think believe you can if you ignore the corporation, if you can do that, then I think you have a political mechanism which will make people say, well, there are other ways of dealing with it. No one is better than anyone else. We can do things in common. And that is the way to go.
Mm-hmm. By the way, again, it's Harry Glasspeak, and the book is Class Privilege, Between the Lines Press, How Law Shelters Shareholders and Coddles Capitalism. Surprise, surprise. Now, you've touched on something, and by the way, I really appreciate the fact that you made this kind of a meditation, your book, because you deal with a question which often is thrown at us. I remember it actually in the Turgenev's novel about the struggle of the against serfdom, and one of the leaders is in arguing with the landowner, and the landowner says, you don't have a program. What's your program? I might like you, but you don't have a program. And the young man, Bazarov, says, well, I don't have to have one, and anything would be better than you, which was, I thought, that's challenging. Now, you seem to have sort of the same sentiment.
Yes, I do share that. I cite an anarchist writer called Graeber, who is one of my favorite writers at the moment, and he just simply says, look, you can't have a program that makes sense. I mean, when people were in the Renaissance and they were doing flourishing under those days, not one of them was taught that they were preparing for what we today call capitalism. They couldn't possibly foresee that. Right? They just knew that they wanted a better world. And for me, I think the person in the street, and you say to him, he's got no program and he's got no policy, that's just simply untrue. That person is in the street because that person wants something different. He wants a society of altruism. Mm-hmm. He wants a society of compassion. He wants a society of sharing. So that's very different to anything we get where we're now, the corporation, for instance, the emblem of greed, self-satisfaction, right? Yes. Not caring for anyone else. For instance, as a last thing for your show, one legal proposition is that we do not have a duty to rescue anyone. That's because we live in capitalism. So if you see a child, a baby, in 6 centimeters of water face down, but you don't want to wet your shoes, you don't have to pick that child up. Yeah. Because if you have a duty to rescue, you would have a duty to look after other people. And that's the last thing capitalism wants. The guy in the street who's protesting wants you to pick up that child. Now, that's a very different program.
Yeah, he would be destroying our system.
Capitalism, yes.
Yeah, terrible. And that leads me to this point, a question. You say that you have, of course, you have a life experience, and you're confident that people will cooperate, and you believe that people will do the right thing if they have the opportunity to do the right thing. And they will not be selfish, just not inherently. And your own life, you experienced saw the German army come to France. And you were in danger of being captured and probably put to death.
Yes.
And you were saved.
who were saved by people who had nothing to gain.
You say this had something to do with your views.
Yes, no, this has everything to do with my views. And those people looked after 7 to 13 people for the whole of the war. At great danger to themselves. And they did it for nothing at all. We had no money to give them, nothing else to give them except danger. They shared their subsistence farming product with all these people for the whole of the war. And no thank you or anything else was required. And this was done by thousands of people, by the way, in the region I was in, France. And this convinced me that people are capable of being human.
Yes.
The idea of a corporation is that we're not to be human. That's why we have something which is a person, which is actually not of flesh and blood.
Mm-hmm. By the way, there is a film. We should mention a couple of films you talk about. But you must have seen The Sorrow and the Pity.
I'm sorry, which?
The film called Sorrow and the Pity, the interviews with...
Yes, yes.
I don't know if people know about that film, but they should see it because it seems to describe your own experience. And you yourself... You did your homework. You went and revisited the families that had helped, and you asked them why.
Yes.
And what did they tell you?
It was pretty funny, actually. They said they were not political at all. I was hoping that it would be political of my political persuasion.
You wanted the Bolsheviks to be in charge.
Yeah, yes, but they weren't, and they were not very well educated. And so I asked them about what it was that had motivated them, and they had no reason except that it seemed the right thing to do. And then finally the woman of the house said to me, yes, maybe we're communists. And I said, why do you say that? I was rather hopeful. And she said, well, that's what the priest told us.
You know, in history, a few people have joined movements, both unions and socialists and communists, because police did say such things.
Yes, of course.
Oh, you lousy red. And the guy says, where do I meet these people you hate so much? We're speaking to Harry Glasbeck, wonderful book, Class Privilege. And there's another film that you introduced me to, and I don't know if I'll ever be able to find this film. It's called They Live. And you thought this is very important.
Well,
films can be important. What goes on in this film?
In this film, for me, it's actually a cult. It's actually a cult kind of movie, and it stars the wrestling star Roddy Piper. And it's really about these people. He's a has-been, and he's rummaging around. And one day, he finds some sunglasses in a big bin. And when he puts his sunglasses on, he finds that many of the people walking around in perfectly good-looking suits and looking perfectly normal are actually aliens who are trying to take over the planet. And so that if you put on your sunglasses, is my notion, if you put on those sunglasses, you'll see the world for what it is. My sunglasses in this case says, look through the corporation and find the people who stand behind it, the aliens.
Aha. Uh-huh. By the way, one can find that film?
Oh, yes. Okay. It's a bit of a cult movie, I think.
Yeah. You must be a member of the cult. we've been talking to Harry Glasbeck, and the book is Class Privilege, How Law Shelters Shareholders and Coddles Capitalism, Between the Lines Press. Boy, it goes by fast when you got a brilliant guy on your hands. So, Harry, thank you very, very much for being here.
Absolute pleasure.
People have been listening to the Taylor Report, and we can be found at facebook.com/TheTaylorReport. And Francois, thanks very much. We'll see you all next week.
Thank you.
CIUT 89.5 FM, bringing you the sound of your cities.